John Barbarossa, Episode 91, The Vice Closes. By January 1945, Hitler had twice as many divisions under arms as in May 1940. On paper, he had 260, of which 10 divisions were in Yugoslavia, 17 in Scandinavia, 24 in Italy, and 76 in the West. In the remnant of German-occupied Hungary, 28 divisions were futilely clinging on to Budapest. To ward off a Red Army push across the northern plains of Germany's eastern industrial heartland of Silesia, Saxony, and then Berlin itself, were just 75 understrength divisions. Once reinforcements were dispatched to beleaguered Budapest, Hitler could muster just 12 and a half divisions in reserve to assist a front stretching over 750 miles. In the west, Hitler would not be distracted eastwards. Instead, he pressed on with his Ardennes counteroffensive and launched another futile offensive in the northern Alsace. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio in snowy Ottawa, which is unceded Algonquin Anishinaabe territory in the free, sovereign, and independent country of Canada. And with me in the Redbeard Studio today is my indispensable assistant, Ragnar the Magnificent Ragdolled Cat. Say hello, Ragnar. This is episode 91 and the first of 2026. Happy New Year, everyone. And because Beyond Barbarossa tracks the history of the Eastern Front of the Second World War chronologically with an 81-year delay, that brings Beyond Barbarossa to the beginning of 1945. You and I know it would be the last year of the Second World War. And while many living and fighting in 1945 doubtlessly hoped, felt, and many believed it also would be, no one at the time could be sure. Last episode, number 90, closed 1944 with the Red Army penetrating into Hungary and beginning the siege of Budapest. That would last well into the new year of 1945, and that's what this episode will be all about. Since we're at the beginning of a new year, it's, I think, a good time to sum up the previous, and actually, I'm helped in that by Joseph Stalin himself. See, in November 1944, the Soviet dictator gave a speech to the Communist Party where he described 10 crushing or shattering blows the Red Army had inflicted on the invading Nazi Germany in that year. These were, in chronological order, 1. The liberation of Leningrad on 1st of March. 2. The Dnieper-Carpathian Offensive, ending 17 April, driving the Germans out of western Ukraine. 3. The Odessa Offensive, including the recapture of Crimea. 4. The Vyborg-Petrozavodsk Offensive, ending the continuation war against Finland. Operation Bagration, the liberation of Belorussia, or at least the reconquest by the Soviet Union, taking it from the Germans. 6. The Lvov-Sandomierz Offensive, taking the Red Army up to the Polish border and clearing the Germans from the last bit of Ukraine. 7. The Jassy-Kishinev Offensive, taking the Red Army into Romania and Bulgaria and resulting in those countries throwing off their Nazi puppet governments and taking the USSR's side. The 8th crushing blow, the Baltic Offensive from September to November, recapturing Estonia and Latvia, and creating the German pockets in Courland and Memel. 9. The Belgrade Offensive and the Budapest Offensive. Yes, I think that's two blows as well, but you can argue the numbering system with Stalin. Not me. It's not my fault. Anyway, number 10 was the Petsamo-Kirkenes offensive in the far north of Finland. Stalin described these or characterized these as great blows, shattering blows, like a hammer hitting the enemy. In 1945, though, I think the better metaphor than a hammer would be that the Allies have Germany in a vice, squeezing its still considerable forces into a smaller and smaller territory. Even though Germany's forces are still immense, as you heard in that opening quote from Anthony Tucker Jones' book, Slaughter on the Eastern Front, Hitler controlled more men under arms in the beginning of 1945 than he did in 1940. But, as Anthony Tucker Jones pointed out, they were all understrength. They lost millions after 6 years of warfare across the face of Europe and North Africa, facing enemies from five continents. As you can see from the progressive maps, that's maps 1, A, B, and C on the webpage for this episode, Germany was being progressively squeezed from the west, the south, and most dramatically from the east. So now, as we enter 1945, that vise will continue to close harder and harder, faster and faster. This episode will look at just how hard and fast 1945 began on the Eastern Front. But before we get into that, let's see what else is happening in the war. Happy New Year, Americans! This is Operation Nordwind. On the very first day of 1945, the Germans launched a surprise attack in the Battle of the Bulge, or the Ardennes Offensive, in northern Alsace. Meanwhile, the Luftwaffe begins Untermunden Bodenplatte, or Operation Baseplate, against Allied air bases in Belgium and Holland, its last major air offensive of the war in the West. 2nd January 1945. United States Air Force B-29 Superfortresses bomb a railroad bridge in Thailand. On the 3rd, U.S. General George Patton's 3rd Army takes the initiative in the Battle of the Bulge. Still, they fail to completely surround the Germans in the Ardennes. On the 4th, U.S. Navy planes attack Formosa, now called Taiwan. The Japanese increasingly use kamikaze suicide attacks, deliberately diving their planes into ships of the U.S. Navy. On the 5th, the German Nordwind operation crosses the border into Alsace. In Southeast Asia, Japanese forces retreat across the Irrawaddy River from the British 14th Army under General William Slim. On the 6th of January, US B-29 superfortresses bomb Tokyo again. On the 7th, German forces from the 19th Army break out of the Colmar Pocket, a salient in central Alsace, and drive towards Strasbourg, which had been liberated by American and French forces in November. On 9th January, American forces land on Luzon in the Philippines. On 14 January, Operation Blackhawk, the British 2nd Army and bombers from the 143rd Canadian Wing of the 2nd Tactical Air Force clear German forces from the Ruhr Triangle in the Netherlands. On the 16th, the US 1st and 3rd Armies finally link up, ending the Battle of the Bulge. On the 17th, Red Army troops enter Warsaw and install a communist-friendly, illegitimate Polish government. 19 January, Hitler orders that all retreats by German units of a division or larger size can only happen after his personal approval. No retreats. No surrender. 20 January, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is sworn in as President of the United States of America for the 4th consecutive time. His vice president is Harry Truman. And on the 25th of January, the U.S. Navy bombards Iwo Jima in the Japanese home islands. And that takes us to the end of January. That's about as far as this episode of the podcast will go. Now, let's get to the focus of this podcast, the Eastern Front. Our previous episode ended with the start of the Red Army's siege of Budapest, the Hungarian capital. The 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian fronts had surrounded the city, cutting it off from reinforcement and supplies. While that was going on, the Soviet Union continued its broad front strategy, put those massive resources and millions of soldiers to best effect by attacking everywhere all at once. To continue the chronological orientation of this podcast, I'm going to begin our look at this episode at the Eastern Front with Hungary, where there's active fighting through December 1944, throughout January 1945, and after. As I said, the Red Army had reached Budapest in November 1944 and continued past it despite strong counterattacks by the Germans and Hungarians. Remember how the Lake Balaton region in western Hungary was so important to Germany by late 1944? That's because it was their last source of petroleum since Romania had gone over to the other side. Previously, the Romanian oil fields at Ploiești had been Germany's biggest source of oil. The perennial problem that the Wehrmacht faced and the Luftwaffe was shortage of fuel, and it was only getting worse. Their situation really, though, in Hungary was hopeless. By the beginning of 1945, the 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian fronts, as well as Romanians, were pushing into the Hungarian capital on both sides of the Danube River, Pest in the east and Buda on the west. As described last episode, on 29 December, two different delegations from both Ukrainian fronts offered surrender terms to the Germans and Hungarians and were shot for their trouble. Map 2 on the website for this episode shows the situation in Hungary in January 1945. Now that's Hungary. In mid-January, the Red Army kicked off two major linked operations: the East Prussia Offensive along the Baltic Sea coast, and the Vistula-Oder Offensive south of there in western Poland and into Germany itself. And actually, the connections here were pretty much continuous. There wasn't a break between the operations in East Prussia and those in Poland. Now, there's going to be a certain amount of geographical jumping back and forth as I try to maintain the chronological orientation of this podcast. I'm going to start with the opening of the Vistula-Oder Offensive on 12th January, then get back to the East Prussian Offensive quickly the next day, then down to Hungary, and then jumping around just, you know, chronologically, day by day. So you can see this is really the broad front. Just to give you a picture, I'm going to describe the arrangements of forces from north to south. So, in the north, for the East Prussian offensive, the main Soviet force was the 3rd Belorussian Front, commanded by Ivan Chernyakhovsky, comprising five armies. But that wasn't all. That would not be the Soviet way. On the right flank, or the north side, was Hovhan Bagramian's 1st Baltic Front of three armies, and on Chernyakhovsky's left, or southern flank, the 2nd Belorussian Front, commanded now by Konstantin Rokossovsky. Yes, Konstantin Rokossovsky, our old friend, he had been, until November 1944, the commander of the 1st Belorussian Front. But he was transferred to the 2nd because Stalin wanted Marshal Georgi Zhukov, a Russian, to lead the attack on Berlin. The 2nd Belorussian Front in January 1945 comprised seven armies with two more in reserve. So moving south for the Vistula-Oder Offensive in Poland, the Soviet High Command, Stavka, ordered Zhukov, now head of the 1st Belorussian Front, comprising nine armies plus the 1st Polish Army, also called Berling's Army. If you want to know more about that, that's covered in episode 83. Also participating in the push from the Vistula River to the Oder was the 1st Ukrainian Front under Ivan Konev, 10 armies plus the 1st Guards Cavalry Corps. Meanwhile, the Red Army was continuing to besiege Budapest, so down in Hungary, we have three Red Armies from the 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian Fronts, plus the Romanian 7th Army Corps. These were the groups that were encircling Budapest by 26 December 1944. More than a million Soviet and Romanian soldiers there had trapped 33,000 German soldiers, 37,000 Hungarian troops, and more than 800,000 civilians. In these three major simultaneous operations, the Soviet Union was wielding close to 5 million soldiers, plus all the thousands of assault guns, tanks, and planes. The Germans had a fraction of those numbers. Germany kicked off 1945 with a bang, many, many bangs. On 1st January 1945, not only did the 1st and 19th Armies attack U.S. forces in the Ardennes Forest on the Western Front in Operation Northwind and the Luftwaffe Bomb air bases in Belgium and Holland in Operation Baseplate, the 4th SS Panzer Corps tried a counterattack from northwest of Budapest in an attempt to punch through the siege and relieve the city. It failed. The Stavka, the Soviet High Command, sent 4 more divisions into this area on 3rd January and halted the counterattack. So the Germans tried again with Operation Conrad II on 7 January. The same unit, the 4th SS Panzer Corps, moved from a city 46 kilometers northwest of the capital. Again, it failed. By this point, this is the beginning of January, the Red Army and Wehrmacht soldiers were fighting street by street in Budapest, even in the sewers, as I described last episode. Many historians, and even some of those who were there at the time and who survived, compared the combat in Budapest to Stalingrad. Now let's zip northward a few hundred kilometers. The Wisła-Oder Offensive was the first major Red Army operation to begin in 1945. In Poland, the Soviets had massed 2.2 million men between the two fronts, or army groups, Zhukov's 1st Belarusian Front and Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front. 163 divisions, with 4,529 tanks, 2,513 assault guns, 13,763 field artillery pieces, 4,936 anti-tank guns, 2,196 Katyusha rocket launchers, and 5,000 military aircraft. Against them were what was left of Germany's Army Group A, soon to be renamed yet again. They were arrayed along the Vistula River, more or less the front line, in January 1945, which you can see in Map 3 on the webpage. The 9th Army was the group around Warsaw. The 4th Panzer Army south of there covered the front from Warsaw down to the point where the San River joins the Vistula near the city of Sandomierz, where the Red Army had a bridgehead on the west side of the river. South of that, the 17th Army. In total, less than 500,000 men against 2.2 million, with 4,100 artillery pieces against 13,000, and 1,150 tanks against 4,500 Soviet tanks, 2,500 assault guns, and 5,000 anti-tank guns. It's an incredible disadvantage. Now, let's get into the offensive itself. And to do that, I'm going to quote from Antony Beevor's book, The Second World War. On 12 January, Konev's massed artillery, with 300 guns per kilometer, opened a shattering bombardment. His 3rd and 4th Guards tank armies, with T-34s and heavy Stalin tanks, advanced out of the Sandomierz bridgehead west of the Oder and headed for Krakow and Breslau on the Oder. Stalin had made clear to Konev that he wanted Silesia captured without heavy destruction to its industry and mines. End quote. Captain Reinhard Müller, commander of the 68th Infantry Division, reported, quote, "I began the operation with an understrength battalion. After the smoke of the Soviet preparation cleared, I had only a platoon of combat-affected soldiers left." End quote. After that initial bombardment, given their overwhelming advantage, the Soviets advanced quickly. They destroyed the 48th Panzer Corps of the 4th Panzer Army and much of the 42nd Corps on the first day. By the third day of the offensive, Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front had penetrated nearly 100 kilometers, or 60 miles, from its bridgehead over the Vistula to the Dnieper River, and were pushing farther west. On the night of 16 January, so 4 days after that bombardment, the 4th Panzer Army's 24th Panzer Corps withdrew from the town of Kielce, about 90 kilometers or 55 miles from Sandomierz. Now, we're going to move farther north again to the East Prussian offensive after this short break.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to part 2 of episode 91 of Beyond Barbarossa. The Vice closes. We're moving on to the East Prussia offensive. Now, the Germans called the Stavka's East Prussian offensive of January 1945 the second East Prussian offensive. The first, to them, was the unsuccessful assault across the Niemen River in October, also known as the Gumbinnen operation, which I covered in a previous episode. While the Germans ultimately drove the 3rd Belarusian Front out of East Prussia, elements of three German divisions, including the infamous Grossdeutschland Division, were trapped in the Memel Pocket against the Baltic Sea. Well, not really trapped, because they still could use Navy ships, the Kriegsmarine, to get out of Memel. And as we'll see, the Grossdeutschland Division moved from Memel further south. We'll get to that. In total, the Red Army brought some 15 armies, comprising over 1.6 million soldiers, 3,000 tanks, 25,000 assault guns, and 3,000 aircraft to bear on this operation. And this is all while, as I described before, millions more are farther south in Poland, Hungary, and Yugoslavia. In East Prussia, the German Army Group North, until recently Army Group Center, until the original Army Group North had been pretty much wiped out in the Baltic states, had three armies with about 560,000 men plus 200,000 Volkssturm militia. These were local German people with minimal military training and light weapons, trying to defend their homes. This is East Prussia, remember. It's German territory and had been for centuries. Among them, they had 700 tanks facing 3,000, 8,200 guns against 25,000, and 700 warplanes against 3,000 that the Soviets were bringing. Again, from Antony Brevoort. On 13 January, Chernyakhovsky launched his assault on East Prussia. Rokossovsky followed the next day, advancing from the bridgeheads north of the river Narew. So on 14 January, 2 days after the beginning of the Vistula-Oder offensive, Ivan Chernyakhovsky's 3rd Belarusian Front attacked westward toward Konigsberg, capital of East Prussia and now the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad. But even with their 3 or 4 to 1 advantage in men and weapons, the Red Armies managed to advance only 1 mile on the first day of their assault, 13 January. Over the next 5 days, they took heavy casualties, advancing another 20 kilometers or 12 miles. Still, they gradually wore down the 3rd Panzer Army, the survivors withdrawing into the fortified city of Konigsberg. But let's not get ahead of the story. On 14 January, Rokossovsky's 2nd Belarusian Front attacked across the Narew River in Poland, also taking heavy casualties, but making better progress. On the 20th, Rokossovsky swung his forces northward, aiming for Elbing, now called Elbląg, Poland. The cavalry corps that Rokossovsky had commanded in the 1930s, beginning his senior military command, 3rd Guards Cavalry Corps, captured the city of Allenstein in East Prussia, now called Olsztyn, Poland, on 22nd January. That brought them behind the Germans, and 2 days later they reached the Vistula Lagoon, where the Vistula River empties into the Baltic Sea. They thus trapped much of the German 2nd Army in yet another pocket. That same day that Rokossovsky attacked in East Prussia, 14 January, Zhukov's 1st Belarusian Front attacked in Poland. They began with the usual Red Army artillery bombardment, then the 33rd and 69th Armies penetrated 30 kilometers or 19 miles. 40 miles northwest of them, the 5th Shock and 8th Guards Armies also broke through German lines west of the Vistula River and headed for their next target, the Pilica River, which is 15 to 30 kilometers west, depending on where you are. Again, from Antony Brevoort. Quote, "Every commander knew that speed was essential to give the Germans no chance to recover. A colonel commanding a Guards tank brigade refused to wait for bridging equipment to come up. Guessing that the river was not deep at the spot, he simply ordered his tanks to smash the ice with gunfire and drive across the river bed, a truly terrifying experience for the drivers." End quote. By this point, the 47th Army, part of Zhukov's front, was moving on Warsaw from the north, while the 61st Red Army and the 1st Polish Army, also called Bering's Army, as I mentioned, controlled by Moscow, approached from the south. German Führer Adolf Hitler was reportedly furious with his army's apparent surrender of valuable territory. He ordered the Grossdeutschland Panzer Corps from East Prussia, remember they had retreated into Konigsberg, transfer south to stop Zhukov's advance toward Warsaw. But they had to get off their trains and start covering the withdrawal of the 9th Army to the Warta River at Lodz, which is well west of the capital, in fact, another 60 kilometers or 40 miles west of where they had hoped to stop Zhukov. Thank you. Now, back to Budapest. In Budapest, the Soviets continued to advance slowly, street by street, through January. The Stavka withdrew the Romanian units on 15 January because of inefficiency, whatever that meant. Then on the 17th, Hitler agreed to withdraw troops from Pest, the eastern half of the capital, into the western half, Buda, on the west side of the Danube River. This part of the capital was hillier and thus easier to defend. On the 18th, the Germans blew up the many bridges over the Danube River, including the historic Chain Bridge constructed in 1849. That same day, the 4th SS Panzer Corps tried to break the siege of Budapest a third time. Third time is the charm, right? But because they had failed twice before, they brought in some extra help from the 3rd Panzer Corps, stationed south of Budapest. This group managed to reach the banks of the Danube south of the city, and by 26 January, they were 25 kilometers from the Soviet siege ring. The Red Army then sent two corps to counter this counterattack. By the 28th of January, the Germans could not get any closer to Budapest and called off the attack. Inside the city, the defenders asked Hitler's permission to break out and escape west. Hitler refused. Budapest was a festung, a fortified city, to be held to the last person until every German and every Hungarian was dead. No excuses. By the end of the month, the Germans had to withdraw from most of Hungary, except for Székesfehérvár, a city halfway between Budapest and Lake Balaton. My apologies for my Hungarian pronunciation. This left Budapest without hope of rescue for the Nazis, and in the gentle hands of the Red Army. And all the Germans had left to defend were the high points of Buda, not even all of the western half of the city. From those high points, they did rain artillery fire on the Red Army, but the final fate of Buda would still be 2 weeks away. So we'll discuss that next episode. Zipping back to Poland now. On 17 January, the 47th and 61st Red Armies and the 1st Polish Army entered what was left of Warsaw. Remember that the Red Army and the 1st Polish Army had reached the outskirts of the city in August, as the Polish Home Army had risen up in the Warsaw Uprising to drive the occupying Germans out. They, the Home Army, had hoped to reestablish the authority of the legitimate elected Polish government, then in exile in London, and to secure the aid of the Red Army in pushing the Germans out of Warsaw. But instead of helping, the Soviets sat down outside Warsaw and let the Germans bring in SS reinforcements to crush the Warsaw Rising. The result? The Germans completely destroyed the historic city and then withdrew in the face of the overwhelming Soviet advance across Poland. The communist-controlled 1st Polish Army got the honor of officially liberating Warsaw, if you can call it liberating, similar to the way de Gaulle's Free French officially took control of Paris a few months earlier. But the situation was not even remotely similar. Evan Mosley in Thunder in the East, the Nazi-Soviet War 1941-1945, quotes Zhukov's report to Stalin. Quote, "The largest factories have been razed from the face of the earth. Houses have been blown up or burned. Tens of thousands of inhabitants have been destroyed. The rest have been driven away. The city is dead." End quote. That same day, as the Red and Polish armies took Warsaw, Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front had turned toward Breslau in Silesia, southern Germany. That city, Breslau, is now in Poland and given its historic name of Wrocław, a hint as to what's coming within the year. But again, let's not get ahead of the story. So now we're at 19 January 1945. 81 years to the day, till the next episode of Beyond Barbarossa. That's when we'll pick up the Red Army's spectacular sweep across East Prussia, Poland, and Hungary. Until then, thank you again for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the first podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. As always, I've put some maps and historical photos on the webpage for this episode. You can find it at beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. Click on the title for this episode, The Vice Closes. A special thanks to all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Shout out to the latest patrons, Robert McKinney, and Kevin Roy Jackson. Also a shout out to the newest members, Mike Kaywood, Nicole Goldman, Georgina Stewart, and Sasha Morzin. It's great to have you aboard. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. If you have a moment, please leave a rating for Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. And if you have a couple of minutes, a brief review would do a lot to help others who are interested in World War II history find this program. Do you have a question, a comment, something to add? Did you find an error? I try hard to do good research, but if you have a correction to make, let me know. You can reach me by email at scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burke. Morse code sound effects by Thane Brown. I'm Scott Burke. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina. Viva le Canada.